Good evening. Venerable Chodron is still away traveling in Asia. I believe she's in Malaysia right now. Is that right? On her way to Singapore. So tonight we'll continue engaging in some review of what Venerable Chodron has covered so far in our text, The Course in Buddhist Reasoning and Debate. So let's begin by cultivating a motivation. And tonight I drew some thoughts that Dan Perdue introduced in the, I think it was the first chapter on the human condition. So we can use this tonight to help steer our mind in the right direction. He began by paraphrasing a very famous verse by the Buddha. Everything we acquire ends in dispersion. Every rising ends in falling. Every meeting ends in parting, and every birth ends in death. He says, although these things are clearly accurate, the reality of our impermanence and death are difficult to bear in mind, because the implication of these truths humble us, and they remind us that our time here is so precious and so fleeting. And so we must do what we wish to do now while there's still time. We have a strong desire to live, but beyond that, we hope to live with some measure of happiness and peace, free of dissatisfaction and suffering. And yet there's no question that we are bound to face difficulties, dissatisfaction, and suffering every day of our life. Although we may want a different outcome, most of us continue trying the same things to find happiness and peace. All the while we continue aging, experiencing sickness, experiencing unwanted dissatisfaction and suffering. So this leads us to wonder whether or not there is any way to transcend this constant vulnerability of death and dissatisfaction or dukkha that we experience throughout our life. What are the strategies that will improve our chances to find lasting happiness and freedom from the difficulties that bring suffering? In the Four Seals, the Buddha taught that nirvana alone is peace, and that our key to freedom is through knowing how things actually exist, both conventionally and ultimately. So with this in mind, then we're engaging in this study of, basically it's a study of collected topics and the structure of debate as a very necessary stepping stone on our way to attaining nirvana, non-abiding nirvana, and utter eradication of suffering and the causes of suffering such that they can never arise again. And we're doing that with an aspiration to lead all beings to accomplish that same lasting peace and well-being. Today I was looking through a book called Tibetan Logic. It's a book, it's a translation actually of a Tarig or a Signs and Reasonings text by Catherine Rogers. And in the introduction, she started with this paragraph, which I think is quite applicable to the book that we're studying. She says, "This book is an attempt to explain introductory Tibetan logic as it is studied and practiced in the monastic universities of the Gelugpa order of Tibetan Buddhism. Since its founding by Tsongkhapa in the late 14th and early 15th centuries, the Gelugpa order has created a system of education and a curriculum designed to enable the student to develop a path of reasoning. A path of reasoning is a consciousness that has been trained in reasoned analysis until it can use analysis to realize first the meaning of religious text and eventually the true nature of reality." So I thought it reframed what we're doing here. We're training our minds to be able to analyze to the point that we can develop a realization, many realizations actually, and ultimately the realization of the final nature of reality. And when we use that word realization, it gets thrown around a lot. Actually, it's funny to listen to people talk in general, like, "It was such an enlightening experience," or "I realized da-da-da-da-da." And when you use those words in a philosophical context, and they have very different meanings. So to realize means to understand something in an incontrovertible way. So we're in the process of learning how to do that, how to develop those types of valid consciousnesses. And so tonight, I thought to begin by looking at the table of contents of our book, because right now, I imagine for some of us, this is like a big, scary cave, you know, and we haven't gone into it very far. And there's a lot of big words being bandied about and a lot of concepts that seem quite confusing, actually. But I think if we have an overview and see where we're going, we might be a little more delighted or interested or curious or excited about what we're learning here. So if you'll indulge me, have a look at the contents page. All right, so the book has four sections, divided into four sections. The preliminaries for Buddhist reasoning and debate. And then part one, which is just this very general overview. Part one is basic theory and procedure in Buddhist debate. So we're developing a lot of basic theory so that we can go on to the second part. Part two is the interactive debate. So it's going to be a while before we actually get to the actual debating techniques. And then the fourth part is the conclusion. So let's just walk through this quickly and see what we're being exposed to. So here in the preliminaries, we had an introduction. Then Daniel Perdue explained the human situation. Basically, he was making a strong case for the value of reflecting on death and impermanence and also the suffering nature of samsara. Why? Because that stimulates us. That increases our enthusiasm to try to find a method to overcome that. It gets our attention to make use of our precious human rebirth now while we have the opportunity and not procrastinate, not wait for anything, but rather to make use of it now. And then he talks about reasoning within the Buddhist context, where, as I recall, he was talking about basically about the path itself, the three higher trainings. There we go. So ethical conduct, meditative stabilization, and wisdom. And there was a section there about how we're trying to overcome, the Buddha was leading us to overcome the two extremes, the extreme of permanence. That's where we project things to exist that don't exist, and the extreme of nihilism, where we negate things that actually do exist. And in order to do that, we need to develop our wisdom. And so how is it that we develop wisdom? It's through understanding a logical system of developing valid awarenesses, valid consciousnesses. And so that's really what debate is helping us to do, is to have a very precise tool for investigating the way we think, and also the nature of how things exist. So that's a good thing, a good section to go back and reread, just to fuel your inspiration for trudging through this long book. Then part one, basic theory and procedure in Buddhist debate. So these are things that are laying the groundwork for us to even begin to understand how to work with the formal debate process. So we started out by looking at comparing phenomena, the comparison of phenomena. And so we learned about three possibilities, four possibilities, mutually inclusive, mutually exclusive. And we've reviewed that chapter four, pretty thoroughly, I think. Although, if you're new to this, then we need to continue going through these exercises so that we don't lose that tool. We're going to be using it a lot when we get to the actual work with syllogisms. And then chapter five is about these two kinds of statements, and that's what we're working through now. So we'll start reviewing the statements of qualities tonight. We also have started looking at the statement of pervasions and what these statements of pervasions imply. So again, this is a foundational understanding. And in my own experience with studying logic and reasoning in the Tibetan tradition, a lot of what's described here is sort of implied or understood. It was never spelled out in these terms that we're using, like abstract singular, concrete singular. These are new to me as well. But interestingly enough, when I Googled them today, I found that they're well-known parts of English sentences. So those of you who are English buffs, these will should be familiar to you. The next chapter, I think, is going to be very interesting, chapter 6, where we start looking at what is a syllogism. And so we'll look at the different parts of the syllogism, what makes something a correct sign, you know, what are these three modes? We talk about the three modes. So the property of the subject, the forward pervasion, and the counter pervasion. And we'll come to know what those are and how we use those to analyze, begin analyzing a syllogism for its validity. Then only two valid syllogism forms. I haven't read that chapter, so I'm not sure what that's about. But there are three types of correct signs. So correct effect signs, or sometimes they're called correct reasons of results. Correct nature signs, or correct reasons of essence or nature. And then correct signs of non-observation, which is when there's a negation included in the predicate or the reason. And then chapter 9, again, we've had a little bit of a foray into chapter 9 by looking at basic Buddhist ontology. So to begin to debate, we have to have some common knowledge, some common basis of the things that we're going to be talking about. And so here's a presentation of the Buddhist worldview in terms of what exists, at least from the Sutra School point of view. So as we have discussed on the whiteboard before, the largest category is selfless. That's described, or that's divided into things that exist, existence and non-existence, and then existence are further divided into functioning things and permanent things, and then we're off and running, and we can divide those into many different, more subtle divisions. And again, it's just it's one presentation. It's like a paradigm. It's a Buddhist paradigm of how things exist. It's not the only way. It's not the right way. It's just one way. And if we're going to engage in debate as found in the monasteries, then we need to take on that jargon, that language, at least while we're engaging in debate. So we'll look at the definitions of existence and non-existence. And then in chapter 10, we go into that a little further, really looking into functioning things or impermanent things. And they're divided into matter and consciousness and non-associated composites or abstract phenomena, I think Venerable uses. So again, there will probably be picking up quite a few definitions, which will be important in our debate, understanding the definitions and the definitions. And then chapter 11, paradigms for proving a comparison of phenomena. So this is beginning to look at the mechanics of how it is that you prove something is three possibilities or four possibilities. Okay, so that's chapter 11. Then chapter 12, consciousness in relation to what they perceive. So here we're looking at the distinction between conceptual consciousnesses or thought consciousness and direct perceivers, which again is very much emphasized, especially in the Sutra School presentation. And then we look into this range of consciousness in relation to what they perceive. So here we're looking at the seven types of consciousness. There are different ways of looking at these seven types, but here we're looking at how one goes from a progression of first we have a wrong consciousness, and then we might hear some information, we move towards doubt, tending towards the fact. They have a funny way of saying it here, an uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is not factual. I like doubt tending away from the fact. That's what's being talked about there. And then there's equal doubt, and then doubt tending towards the fact. And then there's correct assumption. Correct assumption is headed in the right direction. It's just that we don't have all the pieces in place to actually develop a valid cognition yet. And so then next you have your first type of valid cognition, which is inferential cognition, and then a direct perceiver. So we'll learn something about consciousness, and probably we'll have to pick up some of the definitions for those too. But those are very helpful as we go through any of the texts that we study here. It's interesting, you know, when we don't have these understandings of terms or concepts, then all of a sudden we get more understanding, and then you read the same text you've been reading for a while, and all of a sudden they stand out like, well, I know what that means now. It's quite exciting when that happens. Then there's a chapter on valid cognition, because that's really what we're aiming for, is to develop valid cognitions in relation to conventional phenomena and ultimately in relation to ultimate reality, the ultimate nature of reality. Then this chapter on three spheres of agent, action, and object. So that's all of that is like setting the foundation for the learning how to debate. Then part two is the interactive debate itself. So I haven't read this section of the book yet, but it looks intriguing to me. Choosing your debate partners, card carriers and truth seekers. So that looks interesting. Statements of belief and rational discourse, a commitment to finding the truth. It was interesting in that first section, what was it called? Reasoning within Buddhist context. He quotes the Buddha, who said at one time, to the childish I give advice, and to yogis I give tenets, or established conclusions. So for the general population who are just interested in finding a happier life, the Buddha gave a lot of advice, really helpful advice. We can take on board the ideas of the law of cause and effect and how that works and steer our life in a positive direction. But for those people who have a very strong and keen interest in understanding truth, those are yogis. So look inside and see if you have that inner yogi or your budding yogi that wants to come out and find the truth. And that's what we're aiming for here. So committing to finding the truth. Choosing your debate partner for this course. And then we look into challengers and defenders, really understanding the different positions in a debate. And then there's a whole section on the clap, a whole chapter on the clap, because the clap has such powerful meaning, and I won't spoil it for you. Let's wait and let Venerable unpack that for us. But there's a lot of virtuous meaning behind it, let's put it that way, because, again, this reminds us that the purpose of debate is not to just to become intellectually clever or to defeat anyone. It's really about helping ourselves and others move towards enlightenment. And so that clap and the whole movement of the body, the stamping of the foot, etc., is to remind us of wanting to bring people out of suffering of samsara. Then a chapter on Manjushri, the special deity of debate. Why is that? Because we're aiming to develop wisdom. Manjushri is the Buddha of wisdom. And then the three purposes of debate. Then we're going to look into definitions, divisions, and illustrations. Those can be very important elements in a syllogism. You can always use the definition of something, the definition of a predicate as a valid reason. So we'll learn about those elements. Then we're continuing to learn more about collected topics, which is one of the first topics that they learn in the monasteries. And, you know, this is the Buddhist worldview in terms of how things exist. So one and different, we have to understand those terms. What does it mean if something is one? What does it mean if two things are different? And then consequences. That's also a very powerful tool in debate. Sometimes you can just posit a consequence to someone, and if they're sharp, they will understand the syllogism behind that consequence that you're trying to get their mind, steer their mind to understand. And then more on the procedure of debate. Okay, so it goes step by step in such great detail. So trust that you will be cared for in this whole process. At no point, I think, are we going to be thrown into the deep end. We're going to go page by page, section by section, and learn about, you know, what are the responses that a defender can say. He can say, when presented with a subject and a predicate, you can say, why, if you don't believe it. We've started playing with this concept a little bit. If someone says, take the subject, it is, and then gives a statement. If you don't believe that, you can say, why. That means, I don't believe you yet. Give me a reason. Or the reason is not established. You know, that there's the relationship between the subject and the reason is not clear yet. Or there's no pervasion. That's talking about the relationship between the reason and the predicate. So these are all different parts of the syllogism that we're going to be examining to see, is this actually a correct syllogism? Does it stand up to debate and challenge? Okay. Then there are some strategies in debate. Again, I haven't read these sections, so can't really say much about that. But again, it looks like he's just walking us through. He's holding our hand the whole way, step by step. So there's nothing to be afraid of here. And then bringing it all together, finally, in chapter 25, bringing it all together, debating a comparison of phenomena in the different variations, three possibilities, four possibilities, mutually exclusive, mutually inclusive, and then efforts in practice. And then concluding remarks at the end. Checklist of skills we should have by the end of this course. So it's reassuring, I think, that he taught this course many, many times throughout his academic career and found what was helpful to Westerners to begin to implement this very, very helpful tool for developing logic. Okay, so tonight I thought we would begin with Chapter 5, Two Kinds of Statements. And he gives us a little clue. I'm going to jump ahead to page 76 just very briefly. If you look at the first full paragraph on page 76, it starts with, "I am providing this information." So he gives us a clue about why he's talking about these kind of difficult concepts here at the beginning of chapter 5. He says, "I am providing this information on how to understand statements of qualities in this system of debate, even before introducing the argument forms, mainly because they must be understood in a way that is different from the way they are understood in ordinary English." All right, so there's a clue. There are some major differences between how we ordinarily say things in the English language and the structure that we're going to find in debate. So even though it may not make much sense yet because we haven't started working with syllogisms, he's at least planting some seeds in our mind so that when we get to this section or when we come up against this in our descriptions of how to work with debate technique, then we can come back to this section and bring it forward with us. He says, "Thus, it is sort of a warning to the students in this course and an important early lesson. However, even with this lesson given early and upfront, sometimes the lesson alone is not enough, and we have to express the sentence in a way that is at odds with ordinary English." So some of this has to do with the way the Tibetan language is structured. And in fact, I've observed translators struggle over the years to try to bring across the interpretation in a way that is true to the Tibetan, but also makes sense in English. And so that's just something that we will have to deal with as we go along. Okay, so with that in mind, then let's go back to the first part of Chapter 5, the two kinds of statements, it's called. So we have two kinds of statements of quality and statements of pervasion. And with statements of quality, the predicate is the quality of the subject. That's what we're talking about here. Or the predicate can be ascribed to the subject. So keep in mind that when we're talking about a subject, there are three parts to a syllogism. There's a subject, there's a predicate, and there's a reason. There's also a linking verb between the subject and the predicate. But right now we're just going to be talking about the subject and the predicate, the first two. So there's a subject, there's a linking verb, and then there's a predicate. And there are two types of statements of quality that we're going to be looking at. So he describes here, through Buddhism, I'm not going to read this whole chapter, but just a few things that I found important. He begins by saying, through Buddhist reasoning and debate, though Buddhist reasoning and debate are directed towards the goal of understanding the nature of things in the world, They depend on words. One may think internally in a rational way while considering the different sides of a question, and that internal investigation may or may not be dependent on words. But if you wish to state an argument to another in speech or in writing, you will have to depend on words and statements. So in Buddhist reasoning and debate, the elements of an argument consist of two types of statements: statements of qualities and statements of pervasion. So these are not the argument forms themselves, but elements of those forms, which can work together to make an effective argument. Then he goes on to quote Lodi Rinpoche telling the story of the two monks who were sitting in the tea house, and they were arguing. It looked like they were arguing about vases. And then they came back the next year, and they were still having this debate about vases. And the tea stall owner was concerned that these monks were arguing and creating a lot of negativity. He said he would buy each of them a vase just to get them to stop arguing. But he didn't understand that they were actually trying to hone their intellectual skills, their skills of reasoning and analysis. Okay, so let's look at statements of qualities and just go through this slowly so that these terms have some real meaning for us. There are two types of statements of qualities. There's a predicate nominative and a predicate adjective. And like I said, when I Googled these, I found that there's all sorts of information about these because they're commonly understood in terms of English grammar. So if you can think back to, what, fifth grade, when do you start dissecting sentences and learning these sorts of things? Sometime in grade school. I remember doing it on the blackboard before the whiteboard. All right, so let's look at the first one, a predicate nominative. P is a Q. So nominative actually is referring to a noun. So it's saying that the predicate is a noun. That's all it's saying. P is a Q. And so predicate nominative is a word or a group of words that completes a linking verb, usually a form of to be, and renames the subject. A predicate nominative is always a noun or a pronoun. It might be a single noun, more than one noun, a noun clause, or a noun phrase, but basically it's a noun. So the linking verb connects the subject of a sentence to a noun. Linking verbs often include the forms of the verb to be, like am, is, are, was, were. They can also include other verbs such as remain and become. So we had the example of a chair is an impermanent phenomena. Impermanent phenomena is a noun, isn't it? A chair is an impermanent phenomena. Let's see if we can come up with some other simple statements. And if we can use our Buddhist knowledge, that would probably be better. I was thinking of one. Venerable Choden is a best-selling author. Author is a noun, isn't it? And she is a best-selling author. It's true. It's a true statement. I'll give you a few that I came up with, and then I'm going to ask you to think of a few. Object of knowledge is a permanent phenomena. Now, this is something that we have come across in our book, but I think it will be explained in much greater detail later. Object of knowledge is a permanent phenomena. So object of knowledge is talking about everything that exists. And what we have seen or will see in the future is that if a category includes both permanent and impermanent phenomena, it's just a convention to say that the whole category is permanent. It doesn't mean that everything in the category is permanent, but it means the category itself is permanent. If everything in the category is impermanent, again, if a category has both permanent and impermanent phenomena in it, like object of knowledge or existence, that includes both permanent. If we were to divide that in half, it would include permanent phenomena and what's called functioning things or impermanent phenomena. So that category has both of those, permanent and impermanent. It's just a convention of debate to say that if a category includes both permanent and impermanent phenomena, then the whole category becomes permanent. So object of knowledge, existence, established base, phenomena, object, all of those are synonyms for everything that exists. So all of those would be considered, the categories would be considered permanent. Just while we're on this topic, the same is true with categories that include existence and non-existence. There's really only one that I can think of, right? The selfless. Selfless as a category includes existence and non-existence. There are probably others. Anyway, let's use that one. It includes existence and non-existence, so the whole category itself is considered existent, if we were looking at that. It's probably also considered permanent, although, because it includes impermanent, permanent, and non-existent things. It's probably a permanent existent category. Okay, that's just an aside. But those are the kinds of things that we're going to be dealing with. These are parts of this Buddhist worldview developed principally by the Gelugpas. I think it's used, throughout other sects of Tibetan Buddhism as well. But here we find it honed to its finest degree. Okay. What kind of statements can you think of? If you're thinking about the things that we... If you can try to include, we could say all sorts of things about cats and dolphins and whales, but if we can use Buddhist terms and ideas, that might be more helpful. Can you think of some qualitative statements that are predicate nominative?
Someone wants to know, the Buddha statue is gold colored.
The Buddha statue is gold colored. Gold-colored, to me, sounds like an adjective. It's talking about the... it's not a noun, necessarily. I think it's an adjective. If you use that same subject, could you think of something that's very clearly a noun? We're looking at predicate nominative. Maybe people at home can think of some, too, or people online.
But the sprout is an effect.
Sprout is an effect. Okay, now that's tricky. I'm not sure. Let's discuss this. So effect, is effect a noun? This is the effect.
It's a quality of the sprout, right?
Yes, but gold is also, gold color is a quality of the Buddha statue. Venerable Chodron is a nun. That is clearly a noun. Thank you.
I think effect would have been a noun in this case.
Do you? Yeah, good. She's looking it up. Okay, we'll have our answer shortly. Thank you. Now, this is great. This is what helps us to increase our knowledge, is when we have a doubt, we try to find some wisdom to cut that doubt. Thank you.
Someone says Tara Buddha is a female woman.
Tara, the Buddha, is a female. Female is a female, so that's a noun, right? Okay, good. Female deity. Yeah, she said female woman, right? Female deity, we like female deity. Okay, good, thank you. Yeah. Effect is a noun. Great, thank you very much. So say your statement again.
Sprout.
A sprout is an effect. We could even say a sprout is an effect of a seed. But the nominative, the predicate nominative there is an effect. Yeah. Or effect of a seed would be like a phrase rather than just the, it'd be a noun phrase. Okay. Yeah.
Nirvana is peace.
Nirvana is peace. Yeah. That's different than saying Nirvana is peaceful, isn't it? Nirvana is peace. Okay. Okay. Does that seem pretty clear? Although this term, why do they use such a obnoxious term, predicate nominative? Basically, we're saying the predicate is a noun. That's what we're saying. So P is a Q, and the Q is a noun. So to make lots of examples then will help us to really make a deep imprint in our mind so that we don't lose the understanding of what that's about. All right, then... other linking verbs refer to the five senses. I found this online when I Googled predicate nominative. So we could say Prajna Cottage feels like a home. It's beginning to feel like a home. So Prajna Cottage is a subject, feeling refers to the senses, a home. Or the chai tastes like cinnamon. It's not a Buddhist example necessarily, unless you live at a monastery. And you have chai on a precept day. Okay. So let's look at the second type of statement of quality, and that's a predicate adjective. So here, instead of P is a Q, we say P is Q. So I think this is where your example comes in. The Buddha statue is gold color, or what did you say? Beautiful, yeah. The Buddha statue is beautiful. The color of our robes is maroon. The cats are asleep. This chapter is difficult. Our daily schedule is demanding. Venerable Chodron is punctual. Titsin Sepal is American. Although, as we find, these are not pervasive statements, are they? Because there are actually a number of Tenzin Sepals. If you Google that name, you'll find lots of things on YouTube. Young Tibetans who want to sing, do karaoke. Here's one from our practice. We grow older every day. We grow older every day. My body is impermanent. My body is in the nature of suffering. My mind is in the nature of suffering. I am in the nature of suffering. So these might be a little easier to formulate because we can think of adjectives very easily for the things, for different subjects. Okay, so basically when we're talking about statements of quality, we have these two types of statements of quality, predicate nominative and predicate adjective. So here, statements of quality are specifically the predicate is a quality of the subject. And that predicate is either a noun, which is a quality of that subject, or it's an adjective. It's really quite simple when you break it down like this, isn't it? And yet it seemed like gobbledygook the first couple times through. So this is the value of reviews and reviews and more reviews. Then Professor Perdue goes on to look at the subject portion of the sentence. And this is where we get into talking about abstract singulars and concrete singulars. So this is on page 75. There's not really a heading, but if you put in concrete singulars, just a couple pages over. It begins with the subject portion of a sentence may be a concrete singular term or an abstract singular term. Now, I found this a little bit confusing, and this is where I think we have to understand the context of what subjects we're talking about that we're using in the syllogisms or the statements that we're putting together. Because terms or the subject, the terms that we use for a subject, depending on the context, could mean different things. In one context, it could mean just one singular thing. In another context, it could mean a category. And so this description here is helping us to begin sharpening our mind in the language of debate. And I like the way he describes how Buddhist language is a special kind of jargon, just like in the medical world you have medical ease, or in the legal world you have legal ease. There are a specific language that is describing what's necessary in that certain modality. So definitely in debate there is debate ease or debate jargon. Abstract singulars, let's look at that one first. These are subjects that we know with our mind, not with our senses. So an abstract singular does not refer to a particular subject or to each and every subject. It's not even talking about the collection of that subject in existence, like if we were to group all of those together. It's more of an abstract reference. So he gives the example, a chair is an impermanent phenomena. It's abstract because we're not talking about any chair in this room. We're not talking about each and every chair. We're not even talking about the collection of all chairs in existence. We're just talking in a very abstract way. A chair is an impermanent phenomena. Even though it is true that every chair is an impermanent phenomena, that's not how this sentence is structured is not talking about that. If we wanted to talk about each and every chair, we would have to say, in debate jargon, we'd have to say chairs are impermanent. I don't know enough about Tibetan to understand how this is differentiated in the Tibetan language, but maybe we can see if Venerable Damcha can explain this to us, or Venerable Chodron when she returns. The vague understanding I have is that plurals are not spelled out in the Tibetan language, and so it might be quite vague in that language. You have to add something to the noun to make it a plural. Oh, like the collection of chairs. Uh-huh. Okay. All right. So he gives another example. The triangle is the principal figure in Euclidean geometry. That just makes me want to run away. I don't remember. I had to look up Euclidean geometry, and I must have blanked it out. But if we just took the first part of that sentence, the triangle is the principal figure, that's enough for us to understand. Well, I guess you'd need the context of Euclidean geometry to really get that principal figure, the triangle is abstract in relation to being the principal figure in this particular type of geometry. So in that sentence, he's not talking about each and every triangle. It's the triangle in general, the abstract triangle. So I tried to come up with a few. One that we hear in syllogistic form often is the self lacks inherent existence. So we're not talking about the specific self. Are we talking about each and every self? My first impulse was to think that we're talking about, in general, the self, meaning the person. We're not talking about, you know, a specific person necessarily. I think the same formula would apply. If we were talking about each and every self or each and every person, we'd have to say all persons or all selves lack inherent existence. So by using the singular, then, at least in this instance, we're talking about an abstract. Or we could say the self is a dependent arising. Again, same concept. Another one I found in the debate book is pot is a generality. So in that example, pot is a generality. This is something that we will learn as we go through collected topics. There are generalities and there are instances. A generality is like a category. And it's made up of different instances. So, for instance, if we use pot as a generality, then we can talk about what would be included in that generality is gold pots, clay pots, brass pots, big pots, little pots, you know, all sorts of pots. So pot in that sentence is a generality. It's referring to pot as a generality. So we're not talking about each and every pot, because each and every pot, each individual pot, is not a generality. It doesn't have instances within it, just an individual pot. Does that make sense? Like, if this were a pot, this pot is not a generality or a category of lots of other pots. It's just one pot. So it's not a generality. It's actually an instance of the generality pot, if this were a pot. It's a gong, but doubles as a pot when you need it to. Okay, so abstract singulars. We came up with some when we were doing the class with Venerable, I think. Can you remember what those were? Or can you think of some now?
With this work, time is an abstract composite.
Time is an abstract composite. I think so, because you're talking about the general... You're talking about the abstract concept of time. You're not talking about each and every moment or second or hour. Yeah, I think so.
Democracy is the best form of government.
Democracy is the best form of government. Yeah, democracy we can only know with our mind, right? We can't know it with our senses. The friend is an impermanent phenomena. So there you're talking about just the friend in general. Kind of like man is a mysterious thing, is that? That was under a different category, but it reminded me. The friend is an impermanent phenomena. I wonder if when you say the, I don't know, does the or a friend?
Well, in the examples that he gives in this book, he says abstract singular terms.
Mm-hmm.
And he also says,
okay. Yep. Okay.
I think
good.
What helps me understand this is that phrase. It's not something in the room.
Uh huh.
What helps me with this is he says in the book, we're not talking about a chair in the room. The subject is abstract, whereas with a concrete singular, then the subject is about something clear and concrete, like the White House or Shravasti Abbey.
Or something you know with your senses. Well, that's interesting. Can we know Shravasti Abbey with our senses? What is Shravasti Abbey? See, this is the thing. When you start thinking about these things, it really does your head in. Like, what is Shravasti Abbey? It's really a concept, isn't it? Although... people come to Shravasti Abbey.
Hmm. When are you in Shravasti Abbey?
Yeah. What senses do you use to know Shravasti Abbey? But I guess you could take that to an extreme, and so maybe we better just stop there. Like, we're sitting in Ananda Hall. Where is Ananda Hall? Okay, that's going off in a different direction. Let's not do that tonight. A monastic wears robes. Yeah, so that's a very abstract subject. We're not talking about a specific monastic. We're not talking about each and every monastic, although it would apply to each and every monastic.
The subject is a singular abstract.
What about Dharma leads to awakening?
Dharma leads to awakening. Dharma. We know Dharma with our mind. And it doesn't refer to a particular dharma, necessarily. Yeah. Yeah. I think that would work. Any objections to that one? Thank you. Okay. So abstract singulars. We can go back and try to connect you know, what's happening here is we're building our knowledge base. We could go back and see how does this interact with the predicate nominative and the predicate adjective. There we're talking about the predicate. Here we're starting to talk about the subject, but we could probably use some of the same sentences, couldn't we? We're just looking at different aspects of that syllogism. Or it's not a syllogism, but that statement, those statements, the statements of quality. Okay, I wish I had something, I wish I had a lot more to say about abstract singulars that would just cement them in your mind, but they're kind of abstract, aren't they? So, because here singular doesn't necessarily mean one thing. Well, it sort of does. It doesn't mean an individual, well, singular means, it could be a category. A category could be a singular thing. So it doesn't necessarily mean just one element. It could be one category or one collection as well. But it's one thing. Okay, let's take a look at concrete singulars. These are things that we know with our senses. Something concrete that we can point out in the world is how Professor Perdue describes it. What kind of examples can you come up with? He gives a couple. He says, I like this chair, or this chair is heavy. This chair is very specific, right? Concrete singular. Is heavy? Which kind of predicate is that? Predicate adjective. Very good. All right, we're building on our knowledge. All right, so this chair is heavy, not just any vague chair.
Our neighbor's horse has blue eyes.
Our neighbor's horse has blue eyes. That's why his name is Blue. Our neighbor's cow eats bread. We have new neighbors. They have lots of animals. Okay. Also, he makes the point that if we're talking about, may not have been in this section, but it would fit. If we're talking about something very unique, like the Statue of Liberty, that may have been in another section. Yeah, that was something else. Okay.
His example, one of his examples was the White House.
The White House. Okay. Well, what about the White House?
As an example,
uh-huh.
Not just a White House, but the White House.
Yeah. Or if we said Prajna Cottage, there's only one Prajna Cottage.
That we're aware of.
Okay. So let's make a few more examples of concrete singulars, just so we bring this strongly to our mind. And again, if you can think of Dharma terms, yes.
The statue on the altar is heavy.
I believe you have a direct perception of that.
The pot is upside down.
A pot.
The pot.
The pot.
Is upside down. This pot, Venerable, Venerable Champa said.
That makes it more clear, doesn't it? This, we're talking about this pot in the room.
This pot, yes. She was talking about this pot. I was talking about that pot.
Yeah, this pot is upside down. So that is concrete singular, and it's predicate what?
Do the abstract singulars and the concrete singulars exist in the same way? Like is a chair, which doesn't refer to any actual chair, is that considered to exist as an entity of some kind?
You know, what comes to my mind right away is just looking at how the two are known by different types of consciousness, like the abstract singulars are known with a mental consciousness, and the concrete singulars are known with the senses. So one is going to be known, the concrete singulars are known with a direct perception or direct perceiver, and the others are conceptual conscious, would be known by a conceptual consciousness, wouldn't they? So the concept exists, concept, the abstract concept does exist, like an abstract chair, or the concept chair, the chair, exists. How is it known? It's known by calling to mind a generic image of a chair. So we can say the concept of a chair exists, but it's not referring to a chair you can sit in right now.
So it's a concept.
It's a concept of a chair. It's tricky, isn't it?
I think people would have different concepts, though. Everybody would kind of imagine something a little bit different.
Well, that's okay.
So then it wouldn't be the same entity that's being referred to. And everybody
wouldn't be the
mind,
same, the exact same generic image, but if you and I are talking about chairs, just abstract chairs, we're probably in the ballpark of talking about the same thing, aren't we? I would think. Anybody have other comments? Or
just following up on that, would the abstract singular equate to a meaning generality? So, for example, if we say a pot, mm-hmm. the image that comes in the mind, would that be a meaning generality? Because we're not talking about any particular pot in itself, but just the concept of a pot.
I think the concept, and the generic image are different things. How you know them is through the medium of a generic image, but that doesn't mean it is a generic image. How you know them is through calling to mind some mental image. Meaning generality, generic image, those are the same thing. Yeah, good question. Okay. Are you wondering what all the kerfuffle was about these terms? Are they coming a little bit clearer? All right, shall we push on? And we can look at this next section is talking about collective predication and distributive predication. Usually when the subject is singular, like we've been talking about, abstract and concrete singulars, then the predicate says something about the subject as a collective whole. This is called collective predication. The predicate is applied to the subject collectively. So, for instance, Prajna cottage is beautiful. We're talking about all the features of the cottage. We're not just talking about one aspect or one side. Whole cottage. Or Buddhist debate is fascinating. What specifically about Buddhist debate are we talking about? We're talking about the collective whole, aren't we? Or fascinating is referring to all of Buddhist debate. When we discussed this with Venerable, some people came up with some examples like water is precious. So we're not just talking about specific waters. Water in our well is precious, although it is. We're talking about water in general and all of the water. The window is clean. We're not just talking about one corner of the window, but the entire window. If you say the window is clean, you're referring to the entire window, so it's a collective predication. The Sangha is in harmony. What a great example. In the book Debate, he gives the example again. Pot is a generality. So that one's a little trickier, and it requires that we have some more knowledge about generalities and instances. Maybe we can't go into that one in too much detail. But the generality is referring to all of that collection of pot. Or that collection of pot. Not to individual pots, but the collection of pot. Pot is a generality. It's interesting because he makes the point in here that we can use pot or vase in this context. Pot is a generality. We can also say pot is an object of knowledge. So there it's an instance. Well, actually, it could be used both ways, couldn't it? We could say pot, meaning an individual pot or vase, is an object of knowledge. In other words, it's an instance of an object, of the category object of knowledge. Or we could say pot, the category, is also an object of knowledge. So you see, there are many plays on words, especially in the Tibetan language. You often get this impression, but maybe even in English as well, as we learn more of these ideas in collected topics. And all of this really is just to sharpen our mind. You might think, what's the big deal? What's the point? But it's learning a particular system and then bumping up against that system to sharpen our mind. He brings up again this example. The triangle is the principal figure in Euclidean geometry. Okay, so principal figure is referring to the triangle collectively. It's applied to the subject collectively. It's the principal figure. So we're not talking about individual triangles in that instance. Then we get into this, as we move more towards looking at distributive predication. See, he's bringing up some difficult topics here that we actually haven't learned or discussed. And this is kind of how it goes, I think, when you are learning Buddhist philosophy, is that it's hard to start at the very beginning. But if we look on page 76, the paragraph that starts, for instance, even though everything that exists is exactly identical with itself. So there he's talking about a concept of each object has a self-identity. Like, for instance, the gong is one with itself. The gong is one with itself. Oh, this is where we were talking about empty sets. And so here we have this example of, in Buddhist debate, a good example of a phenomena that does not exemplify itself is definition. This is wordplay. That's all it is. It's just wordplay. So in order to mark clearly that it doesn't exemplify itself, we have to express this oddly as definition is not a definition. Why is definition not a definition? It's a definiendum. Yeah. Although definition is the word for definition, it's not actually a definition itself. Okay, so the odd part here is that it's not expressed with an article before the subject as it normally would be in English. A definition is not a definition. Is that correct? A definition is not a definition. No, it's not. Why is it not correct?
Because by being a definition, it meets the criteria of being a definition because it defines something. Therefore, it is a definition.
A definition would be a definition,
right,
wouldn't it?
Yes. By the fact of being able to be defining something.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas definition, the word in and of itself, does not define anything. And therefore would not be a definition.
Right. Okay, just wordplay. Just to make you sharp. You feel sharper? Not yet? Well, okay. We actually don't get to a discussion about definitions and how they are triply qualified, substantially existent until page 305, so stay tuned. We're going to learn a lot more about definitions and definiendums, which are imputedly existent. Okay, the way of trying to express the fact that definition does not exemplify itself is more than curious, because a definition would have to be a definition. If something qualifies as a subject in this sentence as a definition, then it would have to be a definition. Thus, sometimes just knowing how statements of qualities must be understood in this system of debate is not enough. We have to go against ordinary English to avoid saying something that is senseless. The only oddity is in dropping the articles a, an, and the from the subject. They may be used in the predicates of such statements without affecting the required way of reading the statements. There will be more explanation of why definition is not a definition a little later, page 305, I think. Yeah.
Would a permanent functioning thing be another example of a null set or an empty set? Permanent functioning things would be an empty set, right?
Because there's nothing that is there. Both permanent and a functioning thing.
Right. So that would be an empty set?
I think so.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of other examples of empty sets.
All right. So as opposed to collective predication, with distributive predication, the grammatical predicate is applied to the subject distributively. That is, the predicate says something about the subject distributively, about each and every occurrence of the subject. We sometimes read a statement of a quality in English as involving distributive predication, but that is not the intent of the statement of a quality in this system of reasoning. Indeed, sometimes English, even when the subject is grammatically singular, we can easily see that the intent is distributive. For instance, man is a mysterious thing. There's that example. So in this example, man is a mysterious thing. Is that distributive or collective predication? It's distributive because, even though it's only the subject, it seems like the subject is only referring to one, but actually mysterious thing is being applied to each and every example, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, okay, so he goes on to say, this is a poetic expression that clearly means that each and every man is a mysterious thing. It is singular, but the flourish sets it apart, and we understand it applies to all of us, women and children as well. Presumably. When we want to be clear that we mean to use distributive predication, we tend to state the subject in the plural, like men are mysterious or chairs are impermanent. However, such statements have to be understood not as statements of qualities, but as statements of pervasions. Sometimes there's overlap, but not always, between statements of quality and statements of pervasion. So we can look at that when we go more fully into statements of pervasion. Okay, that's probably enough for one night, don't you think? Oh, yeah? Okay. So on one hand, it does start to become more clear when we go back through it just more slowly, make a lot of examples. On the other hand, if someone asked me a question right now, I have to go through it in sequence to remember, okay, what was the first set, or the first set division, predicate nominative, predicate adjective, and then we looked at singular, concrete, abstract singular, concrete singular, and then distributive predication, collective predication. So it might be interesting to take those six concepts, those six terms, and just work them with different statements. Maybe take a few statements and see if you can find a statement that fits three of them, or, you know, just play with them to see how there's overlap with some, or how they can be understood in different contexts. Okay, so we'll stop there. Let's take a moment to rejoice that we even know what we're talking about a little bit, that we have interest in this sort of thing. No, seriously, that we have an opportunity to study this is quite amazing. Yeah, you have a question? Or
I was just thinking about the collective predication and how, like, Prajna Cottage is beautiful. You can see how these things are constructed by our minds, because if you took any one piece of Prajna Cottage, I'm not sure you would say it was beautiful. If you took, like, one brick or the doorknob or the roof or piece of concrete, you wouldn't say that's beautiful. So how does a bunch of not beautiful things together make beauty? And it's the same with human beings, like with bodies. You know, if you took apart the body, any one piece is not beautiful. But why would it be beautiful when you put it together?
Yeah.
So it's a strange phenomenon when we sort of gloss a whole collection of parts as each thing is suddenly beautiful when they're not.
Yeah, merely labeled beautiful. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I don't know. It's an interesting thing to... Beautiful is a subjective statement. Right. So to label something beautiful would depend on many things, wouldn't it? It would depend on our discrimination. It would also depend on our karma. It might depend on the cultural agreements that we make. Like, this is beautiful, that's not beautiful.
If a man came in here really angry and looked at it and said, that's not beautiful, it's ugly to me. But he walks in the next day, it might be beautiful to him. It's very subjective to each individual person.
Right, as we know. The same thing can look very different on two different days or two different moments. Yeah. Friend, enemy, stranger, right? All in one day. Yeah. So it depends on many conditions coming together. So again, let's take a moment to rejoice that we've done this tonight, and we can dedicate